Hey, welcome into another episode of BitFlip, the show where we take a look at the pragmatic side of infrastructure and the wider conversation around technology. I'm your host, Alex.
I'm Adam.
I'm Stephen.
And I'm Jeff.
So first up today, we're going to dive into some Computex news. NVIDIA had a busy week last week talking about local AI and the NVIDIA RTX Spark. Which one of you added this to the doc? Was it you, Adam?
That was me. Yeah, I found this one pretty interesting. So what they actually announced here was a laptop version of this little sucker. So they've been behind the scenes working with Microsoft on the, what did they call it? The RTX Spark, which is basically a NVIDIA CPU, 20 cores, ARM-based cores. I think they pulled that from MediaTek. I think they partnered with them on the actual core design for the CPU. And then on the RTX side, it's Blackwell for the GPU. And from what I've been reading, it's an equivalent of like a 5700 as far as performance on that side. So it's a beefy little sucker.
A 5700 what, though?
Do you mean 5070?
Yeah. Oh, did I say 50? No, okay, yeah, it's a 57. It's a 5070, like the RTX 5070.
Ooh. Wow.
Mobile.
That's quite the thing.
It's not bad at all. Oh, okay.
Yeah. But you missed the best part. 128 gigabytes of unified memory.
Yeah. This is NVIDIA making a statement. I mean, actually, AMD made the statement last year with the Strix platform. And so actually, I think this is probably NVIDIA's way of trying to play catch up. But what's most interesting about this for me is that it's not just a GPU. It's also a CPU capable architecture. Like, it can do normal instruction sets and run a normal kind of ARM-based operating system.
And to that point, actually, the way that I frame it is that it's very much, and I think, trying to compete or one up the Mac kind of unified memory system on a chip type of architecture.
That's true. That's where it started, isn't it? It was the M1, the Apple Silicon M1 chip.
Yeah, I think that's
too powerful.
Closest parallel, I would say. And what's to be determined still is how is the battery life gonna look on this machine. I've heard already, though, when they're putting it under some performance stress testing, it does ramp up those fans pretty hard. So that's a differentiating factor already from like a MacBook Pro, but it could be really interesting. And I think Microsoft is they're specifically going after the MacBook Pro. If you look at their design for the new Surface laptop, I believe it's a 15 inch, it's not 16, but it's got a mini LED display. It actually gets brighter than the MacBooks. It looks like a MacBook, haptic touchpad, really nice keyboard on that thing. They're kind of gunning for them. Now, the possible Achilles heel, we'll see how this plays out, is it's Windows. It's Windows on ARM.
You really missed the other Achilles heel. We haven't talked about pricing yet.
Oh, that's true. Well,
I didn't know they released it.
But if you get a 128 gigs of unified memory in a MacBook, you're going to pay about the same. So you're paying out the nose.
I'm not saying it's not unreasonable. I'm just saying this is not for the faint of heart. It's, you know, the DGX Spark, which is the desktop equivalent, it starts at $3,500. So I imagine this is going to be probably the $2,500 price range, if I had a guess.
But that is kind of irrelevant. I mean, yes, the price is important because it determines ultimately who's going to buy it. But I think what's more interesting about this entire product is the signal that it sends from the top being NVIDIA. You know, their bread and butter is selling incredibly expensive bits of silicon to data center customers for tens of thousands of dollars for a single GPU. And here they are building a computer capable or an architecture capable eventually, maybe not today, but in a few years, capable of invalidating or even augmenting that data center strategy. They want to own both places. They want to own the cloud compute and also what's on your desk, which I find fascinating.
It's a different angle to come at too. They're going for the high-end pro first, which we haven't seen that from the ARM perspective, right? Specifically with some of these, like the Qualcomms, they kind of claimed that when they came out the gate, oh, this is going to be the equivalent of a high-end x86 offering from Intel or AMD didn't really pan out, honestly. So I'm interested to see how this compares. But I think, again, so that's the whole, the software is going to be the linchpin is what I think. The hardware, I have no doubt that hardware is kick-ass. But oh, yeah. Windows on ARM. So the question is did the trillion-dollar company NVIDIA pushing in this direction and Microsoft wanting this as well, is that going to get more movement, more investment into getting native ARM ports over on the Windows side?
I thought that was a solved problem by now, isn't it? I mean, we've had ARM on...
Yeah, there is an ARM version of 11, like Windows 11.
For sure.
We know this,
but that's
right?
Not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that a lot of it's been still running through compatibility layers to get, you know, the x86 software to run on that platform. Sure. A lot of things have moved. You know, you get your browsers and a lot of what people use on the day-to-day, for sure. But there are still quite a few things, and games have been kind of a linchpin on that side, too. But there was some interesting... When I was watching the reviews of these units, they were showing Cyberpunk and some interesting games running at seemingly full speed without any hitches and whatnot. So I wonder how much they're taking advantage of. Can't remember what that translation layer that Steam created
Proton?
For
Proton. Mm. Oh, you're thinking the one for the one that they're going to have on the Steam frame.
Yes.
Oh.
It's a box 86.
I will look it up while you guys are talking.
Something like that. But interested to see how they're doing that once people get to peek under the hood. It was pretty much a closed box kind of review, or all of the reviews that I saw seemed to be that way, where it's like, okay, here's what you can do with this box, and here's what you can't do, which is mostly can't do on that list. So, but it looks compelling. I mean, from a design perspective, it looks just as compelling as a MacBook. And the one that I'm really looking at here is specifically the Microsoft Surface. That's not even speaking to all the other vendors, because everybody kind of, all the majors hopped on board. We got Asus, MSI, I think HP might be on that list too.
Yep, Dell, Lenovo, all of them.
Everybody's jumping on.
I wonder if this is going to be an attractive option for your customers, Stephen, in MSP land, who are on the small to medium end of business spend and don't necessarily want to sink their teeth into an Anthropic subscription for tens of thousands of dollars a year, or an OpenAI or Gemini subscription for the same. And they want to just have this stuff locally. I mean, some of your customers, I'm sure, have local compliance needs as well. You know, like stuff can't leave the country or can't leave the building, or like depending on the sector they're in. I wonder if these kinds of local devices that they just shove under a desk somewhere, like the Spark, you know, that we have now, or indeed a laptop, are they compelling?
So first off, I don't have a ton of clients that want to do local AI models, mostly because it's not a simple installer where they double click a thing and an application loads and it's instantly working, right? Claude or any of the other ones, you literally just install the application and you can get going even without any subscription. You just start typing and it just starts taking all your info in, right? So first off, I'm excited for things that are coming out like this, mostly because it does show major hardware vendors trying to give you the ability to do local. And so that kind of makes me wonder if NVIDIA and stuff is actually going to start building a product out for being in your own building. Like, am I going to be able to download a Claude that is actually like the local Claude edition? I don't know. But if the major vendors are pushing this way, one has to assume that people will try to make money that way. Maybe it's a fraction of the price that a normal Claude cloud version would be. I don't know. But to your question, anyone that is doing any sort of AI stuff right now, from my customers' perspectives, and that'll be like medical field and whatnot, they just rely on what is available from, say, like their 365 instance, because you sign up for their Copilot, which, be it good or bad, if you're paying the license and whatnot in the end user agreement, they basically say that they're not training on your data. And so with certain loose morals on that situation, I think most people are willing to just say, yeah, that's perfectly fine. I really want the AI thing, and I don't necessarily worry too much about it. I don't have any lawyers, and so I don't want to kind of go down that avenue, because I think, from what I understand, lawyers can be a little pickier about what leaves and what doesn't. So yeah,
I'm just waiting for Jeff to interject at this point.
I'm waiting for him to jump. Right?
Lawyer hat.
But yeah, Jeff, I mean, feel free. What do you think on that?
So it's actually interesting, because I don't want to get too much into this, but my employer recently came out with an AI policy, and we've been, because again, judges and all that are trying to work out AI. I mean, AI is everywhere. You have attorneys using it and claiming, oh, I didn't know that it could hallucinate and, you know, make up cases and all that. And so like, I've been using it for work, but I also have to keep in mind, like, you know, confidentiality, where I'm putting things. Like if I'm putting in contracts or stuff like that, I usually go in, I'll substitute out names of parties and things like that. So I'm not putting, cause I mean, I'm using Claude right now, you know, for my own personal, you know, subscription. However, my IT department is actually working on using Microsoft's Copilot and basically running it on premises and giving access kind of through a web portal for everyone in the office. And that will hopefully be, again, it's local-ish, so it shouldn't give up confidentiality. But I have not gotten a chance to use it yet, so I'll be curious to see how that goes.
Are we trusting Microsoft to not, you know, pinky swear? We won't leave the building. Of all companies.
I actually have read Microsoft's terms and conditions when it comes to AI, because I had questions from...
Oh, well, let's hear it, because I think you're probably one of the three people on Earth that has.
Oh, dear God. Microsoft is one of the worst companies when it comes to their terms. It is literally, it'll be like, here are the terms and conditions. Here are these 17 other agreements and things that are incorporated, but not all of them are incorporated in this other document. Well, they are absolutely the worst company I have ever dealt with in terms of contracts. There is nothing explicit in their contract that says that they will train on user data. There's also nothing explicit in the contract that says they will not train on user data.
Which means they will.
Yeah, there is enough language in there that I think they'd have a hard time doing it. Because there is language on there about, you know, you own your data and things like that, and they can use it for, like, you know, usage data and stuff like that. So there could be some data used for training, but your actual, like, hey, can you tell me about, you know, how to make a bomb? I'm just making, you know. That should not be trained.
Back to the laptop. I have a question for Steven on this also. Given that the majority of your customer base, if not all, are running Windows, is this would this be something that would be compelling to you at all for your own personal use?
That laptop, certainly. If I wanted to spend that much money on a laptop, then yeah, I think it would be pretty good. I'd use a Mac every day, and that's just my normal thing. And so inherently, I'd really love a Mac that had all of the RAM so I could try this stuff. But certainly from a PC perspective, if it had really nice hardware, I'd love to try it for sure.
But it's not compelling specifically because of the customer base? Doesn't register?
No, not for my usage. No one pretty much is going to spend that much on a laptop that I sell. Like right now, understandably, your pricing is a bit different than my pricing, right? And so you say $2,500 and that ends up being $3,500 here. And so most businesses that I deal with don't want to spend $2,500 on a laptop. They want to spend $1,500 Canadian, and that's at the high end, because they're just going to cycle them out every few years, right? So no, I don't have a huge go for it. But the exciting part for me is what it will mean for local LLM in the future.
Cool.
Couldn't they have made it something easier to say?
LLM. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, let's just trip over it every single time, right?
Yeah.
Before we move on, here's just one last thought: is will Linux come to these boxes? Because they are open bootloaders.
Definitely 100%. Has to. Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe not the Surface.
It was a short answer, wasn't it? Yes, it will. I don't see how it can't, because it's the first class citizen for containers. For a lot of the model development happens on Linux, and on the server side in the cloud, it runs on Linux. So why wouldn't you just want to port that whole cloth locally? And the Linux desktop is better than ever. So why not?
Oh, one last thing. Sorry to keep doing this. FX. That was the Valve runtime thing. I looked it up.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, housekeeping time. Let's just remind everybody where they can get in touch with us and support the show. You can go to bitflip.show to find out more about us and our wonderful patrons who support the show. You can get in touch with us at contact@bitflip.show. Speaking of patrons, we have our first terabyte tier supporter. So a big thank you to Badnet Mask for supporting the show. And, you know, if you want to get your name in the show and be preserved for perpetuity, or in perpetuity, I should say, please support the show at the terabyte tier or greater, and you'll get a shout out every episode. Big thank you to everybody that has supported us already. There are quite a few of you. It's been quite a pleasant surprise how many. So please, we would love to, I don't know, keep bringing this show to you without, you know, paying for it out of our own pockets, you know what I mean? So, please help us to help you keep bringing this show. And big thank you from me. Big thank you from the other three as well to everybody who's a patron. So you can head over to bitflip.show/support to find out about our patron tiers.
And we did have our first behind-the-scenes episode where we diagnosed some networking shenanigans. So if you're at all interested in learning more about the show and kind of just watching us do our thing, by all means, please subscribe.
Attempted to diagnose the network issue.
Yeah, true. We didn't quite fully. other than figuring out Stephen's internet is the problem.
Blame Canada.
I mean, an hour and a half of us running iPerf tests. I don't know how interesting that was, but anyway.
But I feel like it goes both ways, right? Because if I try to write to you, then all of a sudden you guys are the problem.
All right, but there's three of us.
That's true. Yeah, sure.
And we don't happen to have fancy data center rooms. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, now I nearly killed myself this weekend doing the Perfect Media Server Part 3. Am I allowed to talk about that yet?
Sure.
Please do.
No.
I want more. I watched it.
I set myself up for that one. Yeah. Well, about 10 years ago, I wrote the very first Perfect Media Server article, as it was back then, on the Linux Server blog. And the idea was just a showcase of free and open source technologies of how you could build a media server, a network-attached storage server, using nothing but off-the-shelf free software. And here we are 10 years later somehow, and I'm still, broadly speaking, running the same stack. And I made a video about it. So it's at the core, it is Proxmox, and I managed to make half of the internet come out in hives, apparently, by talking about running containers directly on the host and not running everything in a virtual machine and all the rest. It's like, guys, it's just Linux. Like, it's just Debian that also happens to be a capable hypervisor. You know, there's one guy here literally in the YouTube comments that says, "What is the purpose of this? Just go with pure Debian." It also seems you install Docker directly on the host. This is just wrong. And I'm like, okay, sure. Why? Is it wrong to install Docker on top of Linux?
No.
I mean, that's what I did.
No, we had this conversation kind of in the first episode, because I do the same thing where I run Docker in, because there are some things where it's just easier to run Docker on the host, like Scrutiny. I don't want to have to create a VM, pass all my disks through just to run Scrutiny in a VM. That is complete overkill.
And QuickSync, if you need any kind of hardware acceleration for things like Scripted, or for what's the other one?
Frigate.
Thank you. Yes. If you have the Coral TPU, like there's a bunch of reasons why you might want stuff directly on the host. To which the next reply is, "Well, just run everything in an LXC." And I'm like, "Okay, been there, done that, tried that. It doesn't end well."
I don't have a problem with QuickSync. The Coral TPU was an absolute pita. Like, I have tried passing that thing through to an LXC and to a VM, and it just does not play nice.
Yeah. I mean, my rationale for it really is that Proxmox is a base, right? If you want to experiment later on, you can. But the purpose of a guide like this is to just get people out of the ground as quickly as possible. It's already a 90-minute video, for crying out loud, going through how to partition your disks manually, going through how to install basic packages and edit config files and all the rest of it. And it's like, this is already for most people just going to be like, by the time you've opened up a terminal, you've already lost 95% of people. And the whole stack is built around SnapRaid, MergerFS, and Proxmox. And by the end of it, I'm sort of left there thinking, and this isn't a paid advertisement for Unraid.
Oh, I was waiting for it.
I promise. This isn't like, I have no affiliation except Adam's a friend of mine, obviously. But I'm sort of sat there thinking, all of this stuff that I've learned over the years now, I could just throw it into an LLM, couldn't I? And ask it, how do I partition a disk? And off goes the agent and does it for me. Do I need to know how to do it myself? I think so, because that's just how my brain works. But then I look at an Unraid product that just handles most of that for me. Yes, it does it in an opinionated way. Same with TrueNAS, same with Open Media Vault as well. Like, they've all got opinionated ways of approaching these things. But like, I don't know. Like, I'm in a tough spot with it, really, because like, I've used this system myself now for a decade, and it just works pretty flawlessly. But I don't know. I look at it and I'm like, is it right for most people? Is it perfect? No, not really.
I was listing in my mind as you went through each different factor that you were applying to the system. And Unraid actually did everything. I can't identify a single thing that you set up that Unraid doesn't do from specifically a media center perspective. Okay. Understanding mm-hmm. that you have Proxmox as your base, and that's going to give you a lot more opportunities for tinkering on things like LXCs and such, and having a enterprise level hypervisor. No argument there. But for this specific purpose, I was like, Unraid is such the easy button for this. I could have had this set up in 20 minutes easily with no CLI. So it really just matters. I think it matters what your goal is. If you really want to understand all these technologies top to bottom, by all means, go, you know, watch the video, go through step by step.
It basically was a feature length epic, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was of that level of quality. I'll give you that compliment. There you go.
Thank you.
But if you just want a media center setup that will allow you to do a lot more tinkering and a lot of their other options as well, Unraid is a great option for that, specifically for the media center. Also, the limitations around performance from the array aren't really an issue. And in fact, like, the flexibility of the array is why you went with MergerFS in a similar sense, right?
Yeah, but, exactly.
I prefer the real-time parity checks also over the snap rate.
I think when I think about where I was 10 years ago, Unraid was version 6, maybe. Mm-hmm. And you guys have made a lot of improvements to the product since then. Like, you've added multiple parity disks, which I don't think was on a feature back then. You've added ZFS. You've added GPU pass-through, when I left, was barely a thing. So it's, I put this stuff in place, like I say, 10 years ago, and I've made a wiki about it. I've written a dozen blog posts and all the rest of it. But like, I felt like this video had to happen as like a matter of record to say, look, this thing exists. You can do this using nothing but free and open source software if you want to. I should make a follow-up video. In fact, I think I'm going to, which is like an FAQ, because I'm seeing the same trends come up in the YouTube comments as well, of like, why didn't you just do this? Why are you doing it this way? And all the rest of it. And in that video, I think I will have to address the elephant in the room of, why don't you just push the easy button and pay, I don't know, $50, $100, whatever it is for Unraid, and just get on with your life. To which my answer would be, I've built a nice career on the skills I learned building that thing. So
I think it's more than that, right? Because you have done it this way for a long time. You've gone through many iterations. I always rib you about using a hypervisor in Just, because at the end of the day, if you're using a hypervisor in an actual like enterprise environment or for business, you're probably not the sort of fellow that's actually going to install Docker on there. Just nod your head that you won't, because we're friends. But in your situation, it's literally a home lab, or it's your home media server. It's just being used as a base to be able to build upon. And so that's perfectly fine. But the reason I think that you're going to always build it the way that you're building it is because you're used to understanding and having the full control in the back end without a GUI. Now, that said, you are a Mac user and you're commonly thrown into a walled garden, but you still complain about it, but you really can't change, right? But with your media center, you do have the option to not be in the walled garden. And you don't
like GUIs.
There's
no good alternative. There's no good alternative to the Mac desktop for my needs, where I'm doing video production all day, every day. And
100%.
Like Linux for that use case, I'm sorry, Jeff.
No, I will cede media creation, not Linux's strong suit.
Windows, nuh-uh. You know, like, I am going in and out of airports and all around the place, and I still have not found a Windows laptop that just opens and closes and wakes and sleeps every time, first time, connects to the Wi-Fi first time, every time, and I can do AirDrop from my phone when I've got footage that it's just... But on the server, there are plenty of options. So, like, there's Unraid, there's TrueNAS, there's Open Media Vault, there's Zimmer OS, there's Perfect Media Server Stack, whatever you want to call it, you know. There's Bcache FS, which we haven't even looked at yet because it's kind of, I don't know. I feel like Bcache had its moment with getting accepted into the kernel and then Ken ended up getting it yeeted out of the kernel. Like, yeah, it's just an interesting one. Like, and there's no one right way to do these things. This is the other thing about Linux, right? There's always five different ways to skin a particular turkey, you know?
Mm. And so that's my point, right? You like it that way. And even though there are really great alternatives, that's why you're going to keep doing that, because there isn't a thing pushing you over to using an Unraid or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think the other thing to kind of keep in mind, Alex, is like, I still use Ansible to set up a lot of the stuff in Proxmox. So like, I can get... And I don't think that's necessarily as doable with something like Unraid. I've never really played with Unraid, so please, Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are certain, like, I like certain buttons tweaked, I like certain things certain ways, and with Ansible, I can go in and say, okay, go ahead and change this setting, this setting, this setting, this setting, and I do it once, and presumably it's going to work forever unless they change the settings. With Unraid, I like a GUI, but I don't want to have to go in every time and have to click 17 different buttons to when I could just click one button, run a script, and it's done for me.
I happen to be the head of quality also for Lime Technology. And in fact, we do deploy our QA lab with Ansible. But here's the thing. You guys are all Docker Compose fans.
Yes.
And Unraid still does not have Docker Compose natively in it. So that would be one thing that I didn't consider until just now. So if you guys, when you're talking about your compose stacks and being able to do it declaratively for an entire stack, that part, that would be a differentiating factor. I'll give you that one.
For now. I mean, there's probably 15 plugins to add it, though.
That is
or
true.
Or you just do what I do and you just went into the terminal and installed it anyway.
Exactly. Now, I'm still neck deep in the middle of Jellyfin June. That was the reason that I finally got off my ass and put out Perfect Media Server Part 3. I needed something to run Jellyfin on that wasn't my primary Jellyfin instance to start messing around with it. So I've been looking at clients and doing live TV and all that kind of stuff. And it's been really interesting. I've actually reached out to the core Jellyfin developers, and I'm hoping to line them up for an interview either on this podcast or on my YouTube channel. I'm not sure if they're willing to do video or not, so that depends on a couple of things. So we'll see. But it's Jellyfin is pretty interesting. It plays video like movies and TV shows. I would say is pretty much a solved problem with Jellyfin. The rest of it. Yeah, some rough edges.
When's the music episode, Alex?
Well, notice I didn't include music in that list. Because I've ended up spinning up a Navidrome.
And see, I don't know, that to me, that's... I hear you, and I actually, one of our listeners wrote in and kind of made similar kind of points about, you know, Jellyfin, the developers seem to be focusing on, you know, improving the UI and... you know, and making some improvements to, you know, how things are running and the speed of things and optimizations and all that, but they haven't worked on some of the core features. But I kind of agree with him on, particularly he raised the point of being able to transcode a download So you, you know, you can have a smaller version of the file. I mean, you could have full quality image of, you know, whatever movie you want. But when you go on an airplane, do you really need to have it in 4K, you know, max bit written? No. But there's no easy way of doing that from Jellyfin. And that would be a great feature to have. And it's been like the, one of the number one requested features. And it's just been sitting there for 10 years now.
But that's because Jellyfin is led by volunteers.
Yes.
So if you want that feature, go build it. I mean, in the age of agentic AI, there's no reason why you couldn't go and build it, Jeff, hypothetically.
Hypothetically, but then would it be merged into the main line would be the question.
Don't know. I don't know. Actually don't know what Jellyfin's policy on AI contributions is.
But I mean, again, I go back to the going back to you. Yes, it can do movies and it can do TV shows. A plus, I have no issues with it. And I agree with you that movies or books and audiobooks and music and stuff like that are definitely not its forte. But to me, that's fine. There are other products that do just as well for that.
It's not a holistic solution.
Correct.
Like Plex is. Although Plex is only good at audiobooks because of the Prolog client, I should say, which Prolog has added audio bookshelf support along with, and I'm trying to look for it on my phone. I added another audiobook client, which I forget what it's called.
Did it start with an A? There was one that I saw that I've been testing.
Yes, that's it. Absorb, that's the one. And this is like it's a really slick client for audio bookshelf. And I think just audio bookshelf, if I'm not mistaken. So we've got more options now than ever across the ecosystem. And honestly, it kind of follows the Unix philosophy of just do one thing and do it well. And so if we're okay with Jellyfin being just movies and TVs and shows and audio bookshelf handling books and Navidrome handling music, is that really such a bad thing? I mean, it's so trivial to spin up these containers these days.
I don't think it's bad at all. That was why I was asking you guys, is music a deal breaker? Are these things deal breakers? Because to me, they aren't. I actually kind of like the separation of duties for some of those things. So Jellyfin works just fine. Really, the only, I wouldn't even call it a gotcha, the only challenging bit for me with it is the remote access part still doesn't have that discoverability where I can just give it to mom. That's the only linchpin.
It never will.
Nope.
It never will unless you add some kind of client, and the clients need to be aware of how to phone home or phone your server, however that is. And I made a video for work about this, you know, and it still presupposes that you can install Tailscale on your client device, which is fine until like you get to a PlayStation 5 or you get to, I think there is an experimental Tizen port of Tailscale actually at the minute. But yeah, it's rough. And unless you open ports in your firewall, which, you know, with the CVE jungle there is out there these days, as we touched on a couple of episodes ago, I don't know. It's not really something I want to do.
Or you get fancy with Pangolin or something along those lines.
You can do that. Yeah, you absolutely can.
You guys aren't setting your parents up with like a site-to-site VPN over a really nice unified gateway? I don't understand.
No.
To be honest with you, man, I ran Plex for my family for a very long time. And in the end, I love my family dearly, but all it created was friction. Like if I wanted to take my server down to do maintenance, and this was early Alex, this was sort of 5 years ago. This was before I'd really internalized the idea of home prod. As a father now, I genuinely understand the importance of home prod because when kiddo needs to be parked for a couple of minutes whilst my wife's teaching or something like that, like we just need it to work. There really can't be downtime. And I don't want, as a nerd, the fallback to be, oh, we'll just open up Disney Plus or YouTube, because that, yeah, it's just a cesspit on YouTube for kids. So for me, I think I'm just fine keeping it to myself, honestly. And it's not the most friendly of stances, but it is what it is. Like, if you want to access it, I'll give you access over a VPN, but the batteries aren't included. You're going to have to do a little bit of legwork. It's just the price of entry.
I would miss the... So there's like an interaction aspect to the sharing that I enjoy. So me being able to tell my brothers, plus I, like you, Alex, I live very far away from my family, for most of them at this point. But me being able to say, hey, I just watched this. It's on Plex. You should all watch it. Let's share notes and like have that fun interaction around it is something that I think I would really miss if I wasn't sharing it out.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose it depends how close you are with your family or friends, I guess. All of my friends run their own servers. So, you know.
Yeah.
Even my sister's husband has started doing it, you know. So it's a tricky subject. Version 12 of Jellyfin is coming out real soon, and they're skipping version 11, or at least it would appear that they are. They're actually changing their naming scheme. So they're currently on 10.11. So that's currently version 11. And so they're moving to version 12 and just dropping the prefix.
That makes... I was trying to figure that one out and I could not wrap my head around it. Thank you.
Some major performance improvements coming in that one, we are led to believe. And a release candidate will be along any day, but I hope for my own sanity it doesn't happen in the middle of Jellyfin June.
Well, hopefully not with any major breaking changes and stuff like that.
Can you imagine the changes everything that you've been talking about?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, well, it may very well do that. But anyway, we've got a whole bunch of clients here in the show doc, but I'm conscious of time. So I think we'll do a client deep dive probably in a future episode. And come back to Jellyfin next time as well a little bit. Maybe talk about live TV because the World Cup starts tomorrow as we record. So I need to get my live TV sorted because I want to watch the England game that's happening soon. We'll see how that goes.
Speaking of clients, if you have a favorite client, why don't you contact us and give us your suggestions? I mean, we've got ones that we use, but I would love to hear what our users are actually, or your listeners are actually using.
Contact@bitflip.show, please. All right. Well, I think that'll probably wrap us up for today. Big thank you to everybody that listened so far. You can find us at bitflip.show. As I say, contact@bitflip.show. Big thank you to our patrons over at bitflip.show/support. Thank you very much for listening. I've been Alex.
I've been Adam.
I've been Jeff.
And I've been Stephen.